From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the Motown sound, we feature a 1988 interview with the founder of The Temptations, Otis Williams. And we'll hear a recent interview with Martha Reeves. Martha and the Vandellas' hits included Dancing in the Street, Come and Get These Memories, and Nowhere to Run. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles one of Motown's greatest singers and songwriters, Smokey Robinson. Next week, we'll feature an interview with the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Interview with the Vampire. And we remember jazz singer Carmen McRae. She died last night at the age of 74. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has paid tribute to the veterans of American wars. He participated in a ceremony today at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery. There he expressed deep gratitude for all that American veterans have done for the United States.
To each and every American who has worn the uniform of the United States Armed Forces, we say simply, from the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Mr. Clinton has pledged anew not to forget those who are still unaccounted for in Vietnam. Mr. Clinton is leaving for an Asian tour today. He'll attend the second annual Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit with 17 other world leaders in Indonesia. Mr. Clinton has vowed to help turn Americans' insecurity about their future into confidence by expanding trade ties. The first summit was held last year in Seattle, hosted by the president. This year's summit goal is to create a free trade zone among the nations by the next century. It's been only a few days since voters swept Republicans into power in the House and Senate, but possible GOP presidential contenders are starting to warm up for the 1996 elections. Texas Senator Phil Graham was in Iowa today. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
Texas Republican Phil Graham said on a Des Moines radio talk show this morning that if he had to decide today, he'd run for president. Graham told Iowans to be ready to see him and other Republican hopefuls a lot in the next year and a half.
The American people on Tuesday night rejected Bill Clinton's policies. And my guess is 2 years from now, they're going to reject him. So I think you're going to have a lot of people who believe there might be a good job that will be open there.
Iowa is the site of the nation's first presidential caucuses. Soon-to-be Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, who was here yesterday, is no stranger to the state or to the caucuses. He won the straw poll in 1988. Other Republicans likely to be in the state include Lamar Alexander, Jack Kemp, Dan Quayle, and Arlen Specter. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
AIDS activist Pedro Zamora has died today. He was 22. Zamora became infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, when he was a teenager. He spent the rest of his life educating people about the disease. He was often featured on MTV, and he testified at congressional hearings and went on a lecture tour. Employees of the NAACP are getting extended furloughs. 88 workers were supposed to return today from a 2-week furlough, but officials of the civil rights group say the furloughs have been extended 2 more weeks because of financial trouble. Most association workers have been without pay for 5 weeks since October 3rd. Officials say they need to go on with the furloughs to keep costs down while they work on a plan to make up a nearly $4 million deficit. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 21 points to 3,800. This is NPR. 3 Israeli soldiers died in Gaza today after a suicide bomber set off an explosion. A man on a bicycle reportedly approached them before triggering the blast. The explosion injured a dozen other people. The BBC's Jackie Rowland reports.
It was the latest episode in an ongoing war against Israel by Islamic activists. The militant group Islamic Jihad says the attack was in revenge for the killing last week of one of its members, Hani Abed. Masked Islamic Jihad activists delivered an ominous warning a few hours earlier at a memorial ceremony for Abed. They made it clear this would be only the first of many attacks. The PLO leader Yasser Arafat has condemned the bombing. He said the Palestinian authorities would take the necessary measures to hunt down the killers. Mr. Arafat has repeatedly come under pressure from Israel to demonstrate his commitment to putting down the enemies of the peace process.
Jackie Rowland reporting. Russian lawmakers in the lower house of parliament are focusing on AIDS. Lawmakers approved a bill that would require foreigners visiting the country to take an AIDS test. Anyone who refused to be tested or who tests positive would be deported. Supporters say the bill is needed to stop the spread of AIDS in Russia. It's blamed for at least 105 deaths so far this year. The draft law still needs approval from the upper house. It's prompted strong criticism from doctors and foreigners, many who are reluctant to use Russia's notoriously unsanitary medical facilities. Several U.S. attorneys are heading back to the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They've met with up to 100 Cuban detainees yesterday. They say thousands of others want legal counsel before deciding whether to return to their homeland. A federal court gave the refugees permission to talk to lawyers last week. The court also cleared the way for 1,000 refugees to return home. Almost 23,000 Cubans are detained at Guantanamo. Another 8,000 refugees are under U.S. supervision in Panama. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a good period for reminiscing about Motown Records. Motown's founder, Berry Gordy, has a new autobiography. We'll talk with him about it next week on Fresh Air. Martha Reeves' memoir came out over the summer. We'll feature an interview with her on the second part of today's show. And there's a new Temptations box set retrospective, so we open this archive edition of Fresh Air with an interview with the group's founder, Otis Williams. He's been singing with the Temptations for about 30 years.
I've got sunshine on a cloudy day.
My Girl was the first Temptations record that made it to number one on both the R&B and pop charts. The Temptations' best-known lead singers, David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks, are both dead, as is Paul Williams, one of the original members. But Otis Williams still keeps the Temptations going, although the only other original member still with the group is Melvin Franklin. I spoke with Otis Williams in 1988, after the publication of his autobiography, Temptations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You point out the Temptations were subtler and more romantic than a lot of the other guys, and that there was no sweating or grunting on the stage. So I want to ask you how you think that was reflected in your songs and in your style on stage.
Well, I think that Paul Williams, who was one of the original members, he always believed in us trying to convey selling sex as well as keeping the class. And I wish I could take credit for not sweating, but him and I especially were sweaters. But we always tried to do things in a top-notch fashion. And
well, you say in your book that you always thought about image. Even when you were in high school and you were singing in the halls and singing at dances, you thought about image.
It's very important, you know, because when you're dealing with the public, it's always nice to set a very good impression. And we tried to do that with a very good image, a wholesome image and what have you. So that has always been one of our main criteria for trying to stay that kind of way, because it's so important.
Berry Gordy, the head of Motown Records, liked your singing, liked your style, and finally signed you to Motown Records. Now, you said that Gordy really had more respect for producers and writers than he did for the performers. And I'd like to know what you meant by that, some examples of that.
Well, he had respect for the artists, but, you know, like I said, being a creative person, you know, he was very into, like, songs, because that's what he was really noted for, because he was a songwriter first, because he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson and Marv Johnson, Barrett Strong. And so I guess he was kind of partial to the producers and to the songwriters to make sure that whatever was being produced at Motown, it was done with the right kind of ingredient, with the right kind of song structure, which he always stressed, and make sure that the lyrics had meaning and where people could really identify and say, oh, yeah, I know what they're talking about. I've lived that. That's touched me before.
But in terms of the lack of power that the acts themselves sometimes had, you describe how if a group didn't show up in the studio on time for their recording date, he'd have another group come in and record the song.
Well, that's true. We had that happen to us with Do You Love Me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not because of us not coming to the studio and knew that we had to be there. It was that this one particular day we were at St. Stephen's Community Church and watching the Dixie Hummingbirds and the Harmonizing Four, because we were very into gospel groups. And so the next day when we came up to the company, and they said, man, where were you guys? Mr. Gordy, he was looking for you all over town because he had to see a song for you guys. We said, well, we were at church. At church? And so we said, well, we were into spirituals, and we just had to watch those guys sing. He said, well, he gave the song to the Contours, and it was Do You Love Me.
I can't imagine the Temptations singing Do You Love Me. It's, you know, I know the Contours version so well.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the perfect song for the group. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know now because he wanted to try it out on us, and I think it would have been designed for Paul Williams. We had the chance to do the song, but I think the record went to number two, and we were kind of jealous, but we were happy for the Contours as well because we felt that our time would come.
Otis Williams is my guest, the founder of the Temptations. Now, the first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was the way you do the things you do. Now, this song was the result of a competition in-house, right?
Well, Barry always, like I stated in the book, he always had that competitiveness with his writers and his producers. You know, whoever would come up with the best product would get the release, and if they did it often enough, would get the most release, which would mean that you would make a lot of money. So Smokey had been writing, you know, and being very successful.
This is Smokey Robinson,
Smokey
who
Robinson.
Was your producer for
right,
a long time.
Right, and he had produced quite a few hits on Mary Wells. And when she left, that kind of opened up a little vacuum. So I guess he said, well, after writing My Guy, let me write My Girl. And so in 64, we recorded My Girl at the end of 64. And it was a big hit came February of 65.
Now, the way you do the things you do, Smokey Robinson also wrote that.
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks.
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies.
Okay.
You got a smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a hand. You know you could have been some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do,
the way you do the
oh,
things
baby.
You do, the way you do the things you do,
as pretty as you are. You know you could have been.
Otis Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. We would always sit around with Smokey, and Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland, would cut it a step higher because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it, but it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
Now, did you have to be above your range also?
No, I didn't do that much leading in the songs that I did sing lead on. It was in the key, because I'm more or less a ballad person rather than the driving kind.
Okay. We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days, we had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie's steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hitch steps and, you know, a lot of little subtle movements. And you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage and say, oh, that's easy. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts, because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special, because he's not an easy fella to deal with as far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there, because let's say if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in, because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you missed that and had to come back in, you said, oh, my God, how am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, people would stand up and applaud because it was something really unique.
Did you ever lose it on stage?
Oh, yeah. All of us at one time or another.
How would you cover up?
Oh, we'd cover up. But somewhere along the way, after a while, you say, oh, no, I got to get back in. So you would find a way to get back in. It was just something inside you said, you better find a way. So you would find a way, but it would be hard. You would miss a few bars before you got back in step. So we would cover it up. We would clown a little bit. Oh, I'm right back to the bandstand to do that, and then come back up and, oh, okay, I got it. Boop, and fall right in. But you would catch hell getting in for a while.
Otis Williams is my guest, and we're talking about founding and singing with the Temptations. And before we talk more about it, let's listen to another of the Temptations recordings. This is Since I Lost My Baby. You want to say anything about this before we hear
this? This is one of my all-time favorites, because the intro reminds me of a movie theme, because it's so big, you know, and I really love the intro as well as the song.
And tell us what to listen to for your voice on here.
I am singing second tenor on this here. I'm singing right under Eddie. One of the things about the Temps, we are noted for being able to sing many different parts. Sometimes I sing baritone, second tenor, first tenor, aside from lead and lead. Never bass. That's exclusive to Melvin.
Okay, here we go. Since I Lost My Baby.
There's plenty of light.
Oh,
a new
yeah.
day is dawning, sunny and bright.
Oh, yeah.
But after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby,
since I lost my baby.
Are singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying.
But fun is a bore
and with money I'm poor. Since I lost my baby.
said Temptations. My guest is Otis Williams, the founder and leader of the group. That's one of your many records that crossed over R&B charts and pop charts. Barry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was really into crossing over.
Yes, yes.
So were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it, and song structure. But he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas, you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
Yeah, uh-huh. And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it like we said in the recording. I said it earlier today, and Joey and Suzanne, they died laughing, but when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and carrying on with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we say, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you
That's
didn't
it.
Want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Barry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Otis Williams, founder of The Temptations, recorded in 1988 after the publication of his autobiography, Temptations. There's a new Temptations CD box set called Emperors of Soul. We have a profile of Smokey Robinson after this break. This is Fresh Air. This is our Motown archive show. In 1987, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiled the early days of Motown and one of its greatest singers and songwriters, Smokey Robinson.
Everybody knows about Smokey Robinson and the Miracles' great string of hits. I counted 32 that made the black charts between 1960 and 1971. Those songs helped to define Motown in the 60s, but you might not know that before those hits came a string of records in the classic 50s vocal group tradition. When they started out, the Miracles were called the Matadors. Like many Detroit vocal groups, they had a female equivalent, the Matadorettes, which included Smokey's girlfriend, Claudette. Her brother sang with the Matadors, but he joined the Army straight out of high school, which was a shame because the group was asked to audition for Jackie Wilson's management a few days after he left. Knowing that they needed five voices to sing the material on hand, Smokey convinced Claudette to join, and then the group threw a bunch of names into a hat, names like the Five Sounds and the Gardenias. Fortunately for us, the name that came out was the Miracles. Smokey Robinson and the Gardenias? The Miracles failed the audition, but met Berry Gordy Jr. there, a young man with plans for a black-owned and operated record company based in Detroit. While he was working on it, he was writing songs for Jackie Wilson and looking for talent, and to him the Miracles sure looked like talent. He sat down with Smokey, and they wrote a takeoff on a popular song of the day and called it Got a Job.
Walked all day till my feet were tired. I was low, I just couldn't get hired. Saw a sign in a grocery store. Help is light, and we need some more.
I got a job.
Sha-da-da-da, sha-da-da-da.
I got a job.
Sha-da-da-da.
To hedge their bets, they put a standard doo-wop called I Cry on the other side. Gordy got the group a contract with End Records in New York, and they followed up Got a Job, which flopped, with a song that had some elements in it Smokey would reuse later, Mama Done Told Me. Then came a song called I Need Some Money, because Gordy did, and then came the record that became the first on Gordy's new label, Motown. It was a fairly radical song, far from the old group sound, and more in line with what Gordy wanted.
She's not a bad girl because she made me
Bad Girl almost sunk the fledgling Motown label, though, and Gordy wound up having to lease the rights to the song to Chess Records in Chicago. It was enough of a hit that Gordy finally had the wherewithal to get Motown off the ground in 1959, along with a label called Tamla, for the Miracles' next record, Way Over There. Gordy just couldn't make things work. Way Over There died despite an aggressive ad campaign, and Smokey, one of the first five Motown employees, was busy helping to get the new enterprise going. That wasn't going to happen until the last months of 1960, when a Mary Wells record, Bye Bye Baby, and a Miracles record, Shop Around, put Motown on the map not only of Michigan, but of the world.
When I became of age, my mother called me to her side. She said, son, you're growing up now. Pretty soon you'll take a bride. And then she said, just because you become a young man now, there's still some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some...
It would take a miracle to start something like Motown again. Fortunately, in 1958, Berry Gordy had five of them, and one was named Smokey.
You better shop around. Oh, yeah.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He's currently living in Germany. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear from Martha Reeves on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Confessions of a Motown Diva. We talk with singer Martha Reeves of Martha and the Vandellas. Their hits included Dancing in the Street, Jimmy Mac, and this song, Heat Wave. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Interview with the Vampire, and we remember jazz singer Carmen McRae. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. ambassador to NATO says the U.S. Navy will stop enforcing the arms embargo on Bosnia. The Bosnian government has welcomed the mostly symbolic gesture, but this has alarmed the Serbs and other European leaders. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
Nobody expects the decision to have an immediate impact on the military situation on the ground. But senior United Nations peacekeepers, who've yet to comment officially on the news, are likely to see it as the thin end of the wedge in lifting the embargo altogether, something they've always said would jeopardize both peacekeeping and relief efforts. They're also likely to see it as a dangerous encouragement to the Bosnian government to continue pursuing the military option. The American decision was clearly anathema to the Bosnian Serbs, whose leader, Radovan Karadzic, had just accused the United States of supporting the recent offensives launched by the mainly Muslim Bosnian army. Mr. Karadzic's erstwhile allies in Serbia proper also bitterly denounced the American move, with the foreign minister, Vladimir Jovanovic, saying it was a deeply regrettable and worrying development which was not in the interests of peace.
Jim Muir reporting. The International Atomic Energy Agency has approved nuclear inspections in North Korea. Nuclear inspectors are to verify the North's promise to freeze its nuclear program. The agreement does not speed up inspections of two nuclear waste dumps. Officials say those sites could provide enough evidence the North has already produced enough plutonium to make a bomb. Those inspections could be delayed for up to 5 years. Meanwhile, the United States plans to help the North get new reactors. The new ones make much less waste that can be used in nuclear weapons. The United Nations says 50 international relief workers were evacuated from the besieged Angolan city of Huambo today. They'd been stranded there for a week during a government offensive against the nation's rebels. Cindy Shiner reports from Angola.
The United Nations says the 50 aid workers, including one American, were evacuated in a joint rescue mission of relief agencies and all were safe. Armed civilians and rebels of the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola had threatened the aid workers at gunpoint earlier this week. The armed men had stormed and looted a relief compound where the expatriates were holed up as the government besieged the city. Government troops eventually secured the compound. A Western diplomat today confirmed that the government had captured Huambo. The United States has condemned the offensive, saying it threatened a peace accord that's scheduled to be signed next week to end 19 years of war that has claimed more than 350,000 lives. During the Cold War, the United States and South Africa backed the rebels, while the former Soviet Union and Cuba supported the formerly Marxist government. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Luanda.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 20 points to end the day at 3,801.47. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Supreme Court says Justice Stephen Breyer is paid about $100,000 for an insurance policy that ends his ties and a controversial investment in Lloyd's of London. Breyer's purchased the insurance to cover all of his Lloyd's liabilities. He's no longer a member of the insurance syndicate. Breyer was criticized during his Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearings over 8 cases concerning pollution when he was a federal appeals court judge. At the time, he'd invested in a Lloyd's syndicate that faced heavy losses from pollution lawsuits. Breyer denied any impropriety, but the Supreme Court says Breyer will continue to recuse himself for a time from cases involving Lloyd's. A former construction inspector is charging that parking garages at the new Denver International Airport may be unsafe because of poor welding. Mark Roberts reports.
Stan McKeldery worked as an airport construction welding inspector from the fall of 1992 to the spring of 1993. In that time, he says he rejected thousands of welds in the airport's 5-story parking garage. McKeldery says he pointed out bad welds on support braces and joints, and claims another inspector falsified welding inspection reports. He also charges he was laid off from his job because he angered construction bosses when he would not approve some of the work. But PCL Construction Services, which built the parking garage, argues the building is safe and secure and that the bad welds McKeldry found have been repaired. McKeldry, however, worries about welds that are now covered over with concrete. Construction officials will spend today inspecting the welding done on the airport's parking garage. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
General Motors is recalling more than 300,000 vehicles to fix suspected safety problems. The company says it's voluntary, and it says it hasn't heard of any accidents related to the vehicles. The recall covers 1994 Buick Roadmasters, Chevy Caprices, and Cadillac Fleetwood cars. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Several Motown recording artists have written memoirs about what happened behind the scenes at the celebrated Detroit Record Company. In fact, the founder of the company, Berry Gordy, has just completed his autobiography. We'll hear from him next week on Fresh Air. Martha Reeves' memoir was published in August, which is when I spoke with her. Martha and the Vandellas' hits included Dancing in the Street, Heatwave, Jimmy Mack, and Quicksand. This song, Come and Get These Memories, was their first hit. Now, the first big Motown tour helped launch your career and the careers of a lot of the other Motown performers. It was a 3-month-long tour. What year was this?
1962.
And before you went on tour, you got your warnings from Berry Gordy about how to behave. There was a chaperone who accompanied you.
We had two chaperones and one man for the men. Thomas Beams Bowles, whose idea the Motown Review was also there to watch and make sure that we did what we were told.
What were you warned about in terms of behavior?
Well, the first thing he did was make a joke about the Contours being dirty old guys and to watch out for them. And they were the least of the ones to worry about. They were very friendly and very helpful. We learned to get along with all the acts, and we grew as a group. We were a big family, and we looked out for one another. We learned to share sardines and popcorn together as a meal.
Salty.
We learned to eat hot dogs that were cold and hot chocolate that was cold at the back door of establishments together. We learned how to hold our water because some people wouldn't let us off the bus to use their restrooms because of our color and thinking that we were Martin Luther King's freedom riders and came to cause trouble as opposed to come and make merriment.
How was the Motown bus confused with the freedom riders?
Because we were all black people.
Your bus was shot at, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. The bus was shot at, and it is just as Marvin and Mary Wells, who were singing together at the time, walked past the front of it. I fell on the floor, and Mary laughed. She said, "Look at Martha. She's so silly. Those are only firecrackers." And the next day, when the bus driver dug 3 bullets out of the sign that said Motown Review, I had the last laugh.
You toured during the summer where there was a lot of riots in the North. And in fact, you were performing in Detroit when you had to announce on mic that the city was burning down and people should go home. Do you remember what you were singing, what you said, and how you chose your words?
I was so excited at the Fox Theater to sing Jimmy Mack because that was our next release, our newest song. Just before I was about to sing it, I was summoned from the wings to come here. And I went over to see what it was and was told, "You've got to tell a theater full of enthusiastic fans that the city was under arrest. There was a curfew and everybody had to get home and half of it was burning." I don't know what I said, but I did deliver it without having a panic arise. There was no one running from that theater. Everybody literally walked out calmly and we all got home eventually to our loved ones and homes. As the city burned, there were frightening times, and I was thankful when Dancing in the Street came out because it sort of helped get everybody back together in that right frame of mind to party together and forget about all the unrest. It settled things, and everybody finally got it out of their system. The riots did a lot of good, with all the damage. I hope you can understand what I'm saying. It let a lot of people's anger out, and after everything calmed down, we saw that all we did was hurt each other and tear up some property. And we've got to live down here together no matter what it takes. So we might as well get on with life and just dance in the street and party, because, hey, baby, we're stuck with one another. Here we are.
Dancing in the Streets is a song about dancing and partying in the streets. Some people really saw it as a song that was associated with the riots, that was almost like a call to riot.
It was after the riots.
The song?
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you make of people who saw that association?
That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book. I have to set the record straight. Mm-hmm. I've been accused of being some kind of leader. I wish my followers would get with me, because I'm out here on my own.
I'd like you to tell us how you first recorded Dancing in the Streets.
My song, Dancing in the Street, was not mine in the beginning. Marvin Gaye wrote it, along with William Stevenson and Ivy Hunter. Marvin had sang it similar, like sort of like, calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat, baby? That's sort of his style, right? Well, it didn't fit me. It wasn't in the right key for me. And I said, well, I don't really like the idea of dancing in the street. But then when I thought about it, I had been to Rio de Janeiro. I had been to New Orleans. I saw people dancing freely in the street and having a real good time. So I said, yeah, I can sing it, but let me sing it my way. The first take, they were amazed. The second take was the one we kept.
We'll hear more from Martha Reeves after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martha Reeves, the lead singer of the Motown group Martha and the Vandellas. Who did you think of as your allies and competitors at Motown?
I never felt that I had allies or competitors. When we first started, we started out together. We all needed each other to become. The Miracles had a hit record, the Marvelettes had a hit record, and so did Mary Wells. But it took all of us together on a Motown review to set Motown where it became, to establish it as a company making its own music. And it was all headed by Berry Gordy Jr., so it's his dream, and he gets all the credit.
You had the reputation for being one of the first, or the first, outspoken Motown artist about royalties and where the money was going. What led you to speak out about money?
The lack of it.
Did you feel you there was money coming to you that you didn't
have? We were
have?
Selling millions of records, and I had read or deciphered my contract wrong. I thought I was getting a third of a dollar.
What were you getting?
I was getting a third of a penny.
Oh. This isn't royalties you're talking about?
I'm talking royalties. And that's what was promised me, and that was what was on the contract that I signed. And I had no idea of show business. I had never known anyone in the business. I had never seen a contract in my life until I typed our names on the one that we signed. So it was all a disillusionment.
How did you leave Motown?
I didn't leave Motown. Motown left me. I was having a baby, and that took me out of society for a minute. Pregnancies will do that. And I wasn't there to hear about the move. I was at home nurturing.
They moved to Los Angeles from Detroit?
Yes, they did, to make movies. It was a move that was necessary because they had outgrown Detroit, in essence.
So you were pregnant and you didn't hear about the move?
No.
And then what happened?
Well, when my baby was born, I wanted to get back into the swing of things. And 2 weeks after he was born, I recorded a song called In and Out of My Life, which was released soon after. And trying to get some response or the continuation of my career, I called and was always told that Mr. Gordy was not available. And I insisted one day to speak to him. Where was he, and could I reach him at another number? And I was informed by the secretary, well, girl, don't you know the company's moved to Los Angeles? When we move these computers out of here, we'll all be moved. And I had to catch up with my life then and go on.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, it was temporary, a temporary backset. You know, but I went straight from there to MCA Records, recorded with Richard Perry, and had a very good album on MCA label.
Was it hard for you to establish yourself outside of Motown?
Yes, definitely. There's a Motown sound that we're synonymous for and we're famous for, and people expect that from you. If you're not on Motown, jocks won't even play your music.
I want to close with another record of yours, with Nowhere to Run.
All right.
Say something about recording this.
I love Nowhere to Run for two or three reasons, more now than ever, because I talked to a lot of guys who spent their time in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. And they said when it was time for the supplies to come in, they'd line up and fight over the Motown records. And when Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam called our name out real loud, I had the biggest thrill because my son had taken me to the movie and said, Mom, don't jump out of the seat when you hear a certain thing. And it was a big thrill to hear Nowhere to Run.
Martha Reeves recorded in August. Listen for our interview with Berry Gordy next week on Fresh Air. Now let's take a look at this week's big movie. Neil Jordan made Mona Lisa and The Crying Game, and then he made Anne Rice angry. She's the author of the bestseller Interview with the Vampire, and she hated the fact that Jordan cast Tom Cruise in the role of her lead vampire, Lestat, in the movie version of her book. But a few weeks ago, Rice saw the movie and had a very public change of heart. She not only loved the movie, but she loved Tom Cruise. Will audiences agree? Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Interview with the Vampire.
There are a lot of shocks in Interview with the Vampire, but maybe the biggest shock for followers of the Anne Rice versus Tom Cruise controversy is that this isn't a Tom Cruise movie. Not really. It's a Brad Pitt movie. It's Brad Pitt who plays Louis. He's the handsome but impoverished young aristocrat who's on the verge of suicide in New Orleans in 1791 when he's seduced by Tom Cruise's Lestat into becoming a vampire. And it's Pitt who tells the whole story 200 years later to a journalist played by Christian Slater.
So, what do you do?
I'm a vampire.
That's something I haven't heard before. You mean this literally, I take it?
Absolutely. I was waiting for you in that alleyway, watching you, watching me, and then you began to speak.
What a lucky break for me.
Perhaps lucky for both of us.
You said you were waiting for me. What were you gonna do? Kill me, drink my blood, all that stuff?
Yes, but you needn't be concerned with that now.
You really believe this, don't you, that you're a vampire?
We can't begin this way. Let me turn on the light.
I thought vampires didn't like the light.
We love it.
Hey, sounds like this guy's going to be a great interview, right? Well, not quite. A great interview has to make you interested not only in his story, but in himself. And Brad Pitt turns out to be surprisingly tepid and uncharismatic. He has trouble getting his mouth around Anne Rice's pretentiously fancy dialogue, and he has even more trouble getting his voice down into the Bela Lugosi baritone he's trying for. Worse, he spends most of the movie looking not so much ghoulish as terminally morose. As the evil Lestat, Tom Cruise isn't much more convincing, but he's a lot livelier, because at least he goes about his blood-sucking with a little bit of relish. We're supposed to sympathize with Brad Pitt because he has moral scruples. He spends half the movie killing rats instead of people. But that premise, instead of drawing us to him, only makes him seem stodgy. Watching a vampire with qualms is like watching a baseball player who doesn't like to hit because it makes too much noise. About a third of the way through, the boys come across a young girl named Claudia, played by Kirsten Dunst, and they make her into a vampire too. And for a while, as we watch this bizarre trio at work, the movie becomes weirdly funny. When her piano teacher corrects little Claudia too harshly, or a doll maker charges enough money to anger her, well, we know what's in store for them. And at times like these, the movie plays like a gorier version of The Addams Family. Most of the time, though, Interview with the Vampire is neither amusing nor even scary. Mostly it's just wearisome and grim. Neil Jordan tries to soup up the story by making the camera whirl and the actors shriek. And Elliot Goldenthal's howling score is nothing if not persistent. But all that sound and fury can't replace what the movie is really missing. Although there's plenty of plasma up on the screen, in terms of drama, Interview with the Vampire is the one thing a vampire movie should never be. Bloodless.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. In a minute, we remember Carmen McRae. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we've had quite a political week, so we'll be reviewing what has happened in this very big week for the Republican Party and what the party plans to do with its control of the House and Senate. Also, the NRA played a role in this election. We'll look at their winners and losers. We will visit the town of Thurman, West Virginia, population 11, in the old coal mining area. Almost nothing happens in Thurman, West Virginia, but still, almost everything that happens in small towns also happens there. And we'll compare and contrast the three big guys in the information biz, America Online, CompuServe, and Prodigy.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz singer Carmen McRae died last night at the age of 74. She had a stroke a month ago and slipped into a semi-coma earlier this week. We asked our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, to talk with us about McRae and to play a couple of his favorite McRae recordings. This is her 1957 recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It, featuring the Ray Bryant Trio.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry skies. It's nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with that one boy, sighing sigh after sigh. It's nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you.
Kevin, are you a fan of Carmen McRae singing?
Yes, definitely.
What did you particularly like about her singing?
The thing I really liked about Carmen is that she had a very distinctive vocal timbre and approach, that you really only needed to hear a few notes of her singing to identify it as her. I should probably also mention that in the excerpt that we just heard, which is from the 1950s, her voice hadn't really changed yet. It really hadn't changed into what we think of as the Carmen McRae voice. As she got into her 40s, her range lowered and deepened, and her conception got a little bit more free. I should also qualify, as long as I'm doing this, that she didn't start recording as a leader until she was in her 30s. So even though her voice was somewhat higher in the beginning, her musical conception was very well developed.
We'll hear some of her later work in just a bit. What was she like on stage?
She had a kind of a tough, broad attitude, quote-unquote. She had a way of being rather acerbic, and yet she had a way of kind of drawing the audience in and making them feel like they were sort of on her side at the same time. And this relationship, this is the kind of relationship she also seemed to have with her musicians, as I understand it. There's a story I heard from the drummer, Joey Barron. We were having a conversation about 6 months ago. And he mentioned that he had actually moved to Los Angeles in the mid-1970s specifically to become Carmen McRae's drummer and got the job after a little while and stayed with her for a couple of years. Subsequently, he moved to New York and got a call from Carmen's regular drummer at that time who asked him to sub on a live gig that she was doing in New York. So as he's telling the story, you know, he's already playing on stage when Carmen makes her entrance. And she's ignoring him totally. You know, it's like she's not looking at the drums. She's acting like she doesn't even know he's there. And he's sitting there kind of wondering, you know, what did I do to offend Carmen? Because he always thought that they had a really good relationship. And then comes the time when she introduces the band and she eases into this really glowing testament to what a great guy Joey is. And that's, and this I should mention was not showbiz talk, but like, you know, a genuine effusion on her part. And that's when he realized, you know, that how she really felt about him. And as he was telling me the story, I should say he was, you know, clearly pretty moved by this, recalling it even, you know, more than 10 years later.
What are some of the high points of her musical biography?
I should probably say, I should mention one thing. Although she wasn't really known as a bebop singer, she did do some scat singing, but it wasn't really what she was known for. She did have some close ties to the bebop movement. She was an intermission piano player at Minton's Playhouse, which was like a hotbed of bebop in the 1940s. She was from New York City. She was married to the great bebop drummer Kenny Clarke for a time, and much later she recorded an album of Thelonious Monk tunes, actually late in the 1980s. She was a piano player. As I mentioned, she would sometimes play piano on her own gigs, and she always said that her foundation as a pianist was one of the things that made her a great success as a singer, that it gave her a kind of real harmonic confidence that let her take liberties with a tune and not have to worry about, you know, getting lost or whatever.
Do you have a favorite Carmen McRae recording you'd like to play for us?
I really like a record of Thelonious Monk tunes, which she made in, as I mentioned, in the late 80s, and like to play her version of I Mean You, which has a lyric by John Hendricks.
And what do you like about this?
It really captures her sense of humor, which tended to be kind of subtle, but sometimes maybe not so subtle. Her great swaggering rhythmic sense, and a really, really good sense of the kind of low, distinctive vocal timbre that she had.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin Whitehead is Fresh Air's jazz critic and a columnist for Pulse. I'm Terry Gross.
I ain't got no fancy bill of goods to sell. Ask me who I'm talking about, I'll tell you. You, who's the one that's got me dizzy and turned round all upside down? Who has got me in a tizzy? You know who, I mean you. Who inspired this emotion? I'm unsound, going round and round. This devotion, you know who, I mean you. You did the dirt, I mean you. One look and I got hurt.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.